Do you, Baron Frankenstein, take this woman to be your bride? Do you promise to haunt her with old horror movies, toys, and comics?
Yes, I want Fran. Woman. Fran.
And you, Baroness, do you take this man beast to be your lawfully bound husband? Do you promise to endure hours of unimaginable torture as he rambles about monster movies and long-dead actors? Close enough. Then by the power invested in me by Count Alucard, I now pronounce you supermates. You may bite or kiss the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 38 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And welcome back to the House of Frankenstein. Yes, by popular demand, we have taken the cross off the door, we've removed the garlic flowers, we've removed the wolf's mane, and we're letting all the horrors of the House of Frankenstein loose upon the podcasting world again. You know, you're probably thinking, if you didn't listen to it last year, you're like, wait a minute, it's September. It's not October yet. What are you guys doing? Well, we do two episodes a month, and we want to cram as many classic horror movies and comics that have a horror theme into them as we can. So we're going to take up 2 months.
Right. Two in September and two in October.
Right. We really enjoyed doing it last time. Apparently a lot of people enjoyed it too. So, you know, of course we're going to do it again.
Well, yeah.
So in case you did miss last year, I recommend you go back and listen to those if you haven't. But once again, we'll be covering a classic horror film each episode, and then a comic book that is somewhat tied into that film.
Right.
You know, usually via the monster character that's in that film. And we try to stick with like a superhero comic that has a monster character rather than an average horror comic.
Right, exactly.
Just to mix things up. And that way, you know, we've still got, you know, since this is mostly, our shows usually feature a superhero, that way we don't, you know, if you're not into horror films.
Go too far afield.
Yeah, if you're not too, we'll yawn right on as we're recording.
So we're going to head into, of course, Hammerland, because who doesn't like a good Hammer movie?
Right. So last year we started out with Universal, so this year I thought we'd start out with Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
Mix things up. The first film we're going to be covering is The Vampire Lovers.
Ooh.
Released October 22nd, 1970, based on the short story, Carmilla, by Sheridan Le Fanu. Written by Harry Fine, Tudor Gates, and Michael Stiles, directed by Roy Ward Baker, and this was actually a Hammer production released through American International Pictures, and everybody that knows classic horror knows that American International Pictures, they released all the Roger Corman movies. They were like the B-picture guys. They released Blackula, I mean, you know, all sorts of stuff. They were like the American B-movie capital of the world or whatever. Drive-ins and things.
So we have for our cast, Ingrid Pitt as Carmilla, Pippa Steele as Laura, Madeline Smith as Emma Morton, Peter Cushing as General Spilsdorf.
Yay.
George...
Cole, I spelled it wrong.
Okay. As Roger Morton, Don Adams as the Countess, Kate O'Mara as Mademoiselle Perrodon, Douglas Wilmer as Baron, Jacquem von Hartog.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, we'll go with that. John Finch as Carl Ebert, Ferdy Main as the Doctor, John Forbes Robertson as the Man in Black, and Harvey Hall as Renton.
I have written in full of how my sister died, how I, the Baron Hartog, avenged her death. The enemies I sought were no ordinary mortals. They were murderers from beyond the grave. For this ruined castle, where I lay in wait, had once been the home of the Karnstein family. And at certain times, their evil spirits thrust out from their moldering tombs and took a kind of human shape to roam the countryside and seek for victims to satisfy their need, their passion, their thirst for blood. Sometimes to court its victim, savoring its enjoyment, at other times to strangle and exhaust at a single feast.
Styria, 1794. The Baron Joachim von Hartog enters the crumbling castle of the long-dead Karnstein family, out for revenge. There he seeks his sister's murderer, a vampire. Hartog witnesses the vampire emerge from its tomb as it leaves its death shroud behind. Knowing the creature cannot rest without it, Hartog retrieves the shroud and waits. After murdering a young man in a nearby village, the undead monster returns. The Baron lures the beast into the castle, taunting it with the all-important veil. When the vampire stands before him, Hartog freezes as he stares back at a beautiful young woman.
Just like any man.
She mesmerizes him as she approaches. Only the touch of his cross to her flesh awakens the Baron from his spell. In that instant, the creature bares its fangs, and Hartog beheads her.
Many years later, and a recently arrived countess and her daughter visit General Spilsdorf's estate on the night of his niece Laura's birthday party. After making pleasantries, the countess is pulled away by a mysterious man in black. She then tells the general she must go on a long journey to visit a sick friend. The gracious general offers to let the daughter, Marcela, stay with him and Laura.
Laura and Marcela become great friends, but soon Laura is plagued by nightmares of a giant cat coming to her room and feeding on her. As Laura weakens, the local doctor is called, but he believes it only to be anemia. The girl's condition worsens as her bond with Marcela grows, much to the consternation of the general and the young man who tends his estate, Carl, Laura's suitor. Marcela often wanders the estate at night, as the man in black observes.
Carl is sent out for the doctor, but the two arrive too late. Laura is dead, with two bite wounds left on her breast. Marcela has disappeared. She wanders on the grounds of the crumbling Karnstein Castle, past a tomb marked Marcala Karnstein, as a ghostly voice calls her name.
Carl breaks the news to Laura's friend Emma and her father, Roger Morton, and tells them of General Spielsdorf's journey to see a friend, Baron Hartog. Several days later, Emma and her father witness a carriage crash near their estate. The Countess, who Morton has not met before, is on an urgent journey to her dying brother's side. Morton offers to let her niece stay with them after their harrowing accident. The grieving Emma is happy to receive a new friend.
The visitor, Carmilla, seems interested in more than just friendship. She makes sexual advances upon a confused Emma, but the two become inseparable. Soon, Emma is plagued with the same nightmares as Laura and begins to feel ill and weak as well. Emma admits to having feelings for Carl, but Carmilla is jealous, telling Emma she wants her to be with her always.
Because I love you. And I don't want anyone taking you away from me.
Taking me away? Who do you mean? You know we'll always be friends, Carmilla. Surely you don't mean my handsome young man. Why, I do believe you're jealous.
Why should I not be?
Why? Because it's not the same thing. It's different.
I want you to love me for all your life.
Roger Morton leaves on a business trip, leaving Emma's governess, Mademoiselle Peridot, in charge. Outside the estate one afternoon, Emma and Carmilla witness the funeral procession of a young murdered girl go by. Carmilla cannot stand the chanting choir and violently admits to hating funerals and fearing death. Later that evening, Emma tells Carmilla of her dreams, including one secret she has kept to herself. At the end of the dream, the cat that plagues her turns into Carmilla. The exotic Carmilla seems to mesmerize the young girl into forgetting her fear of her.
Emma wakes from her sleep screaming, and Mademoiselle Peridot comes to her aid. She finds two puncture wounds on her breast. Carmilla says it must have come from a brooch she gave Emma and offers one to the governess. She then puts Peridot under her spell and seduces her.
She gets around. The family butler, Renton, has taken notice of how ill Emma is and wishes to contact the doctor, but Peridot, now under Carmilla's control, blocks him. At a tavern in town, Renton learns of several deaths in the area, all which seem to match the mark of the vampire. Renton calls upon the doctor, who visits the estate the next day. The doctor places a cross pendant around Emma's neck and orders garlic flowers be placed in her room at all times. A furious Mademoiselle Peridot attempts to refuse these remedies, leaving Renton and the doctor to believe her to be the vampire. On his way back home, the doctor is attacked and murdered in the woods by Carmilla.
Morton returns, and Ritten and the local innkeeper inform him of the Karnstein curse and the actions of Baron Hartog all those years before. On his way to see the doctor, Morton runs into General Spiersdorf, Baron Hartog, and Carl, who have retrieved the doctor's ravaged body. Morton accompanies them to Karnstein Castle. There, the Baron recounts the night he slayed the vampire and how he discovered the other tombs of her undead family and staked them in their graves. He found all of the graves except one. He shows his friends a portrait of the missing Karnstein, Markala. Filsdorf instantly recognizes her as Laura's murderer, Markala, and Morton is horrified to find she looks exactly like Carmilla.
There was one grave I did not find. That of a young girl. After the horrors of the night, I could not spend another moment in this place. Here is her sweet and gentle face. Mircala.
Marcella. That girl is a guest in my house. Her name is Carmilla. And my daughter is dying.
Morton, wait.
Eberhard knows every inch of these forests. He'll get to your house in half the time. For God's sake, save her!
As Carl heads out to save Emma from her, Carmilla uses her persuasive powers on Ritten, who orders the removal of the cross and garlic flowers.
The vampire hunters find Mircala's tomb, but it's empty. The coffin hits somewhere else on the grounds. After murdering Ritten, Carmilla awakens Emma, who is near death, and tells her she is taking her home with her. As she leaves, Mademoiselle Peridot begs her to take her with her. Carmilla savagely attacks Peridot in front of a horrified Emma. Carl enters the house and brandishes his sword at the vampire. Carmilla overpowers him, but as she bares her fangs, he pulls a knife and holds it to her like a cross. She backs away and vanishes as Carl's thrown dagger flies through her disappearing body.
Carmilla returns to her family castle as Spielsdorf, Hartog, and Morton watch. They follow her inside, and Morton spies her familiar necklace on the floor near her portrait. Beneath the floor lies her coffin. The men move it into the chapel where General Spiersdorf first stakes and then decapitates the vampire. At the moment of Markala's destruction, Emma screams in pain with Carl comforting her. The men replace Markala's coffin in her proper tomb as the man in black watches with a stern look. Markala's beautiful portrait mysteriously ages and decays into the skeleton of a vampire.
Dun, dun, dun. So, just right off the bat, this story by Sheridan Le Fanu predates Bram Stoker's Dracula by a good 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
There had been other vampire stories, but this one has quite a bit of influence on Dracula. I have read this story before. I have it, but I have not read it all the way through in a while. But the movie actually tackles the events in a more linear fashion. Where in the original, it's narrated by Emma as she relates the events. You find out Laura's fate via the letter they read from the general and mm-hmm. things like that. So this actually, you know, tackles things in a timeline fashion. One kind of strange thing in the short story, Emma was attacked by Mircala as a young girl. Although her and her father and the housekeepers assured her it was just a dream. She saw her face. The large furry cat was on her bed,
mm-hmm.
and then she saw her face, and then she like went underneath the bed. It was kind of creepy the way that he described it. But years later, when they met, she recognized her, and Carmilla passed it off as recognizing her as well, like they'd had some kind of weird shared dream or something.
Weird.
Yeah.
So that was just an added thing that the movie just took off, you know.
Yeah, I think it would have just muddied the
waters,
the narration
yeah.
of the movie. And also the Baron's story wasn't fleshed out like it was in the short story, as I remember it. And he was called Baron Wardenberg. I looked that up real quick, so that was kind of strange that Baron Hartog sounds better. One thing that, you know, obviously a wrinkle that was dropped by everybody that went forward. I don't know if the shroud business was in the book, was in the story, original story or not, but mm-hmm. that's obviously something that wasn't picked up. But the whole anagram thing of the name.
Right.
That she had to have a name that was, you know, Mircala, Marcella, Carmilla. It was just, you know, a mixing.
A rearranging of the letters.
Rearranging of the letters. Yeah, that was something that they definitely didn't. Well, I guess they kind of did when you got Alucard being used for Dracula everywhere.
Well, that's, you know.
I mean, you think about it. I mean, maybe when that was used in the first time I know of that being used was in Son of Dracula with Lon Chaney Jr. Mm-hmm. And then of course you get it in the Monster Squad and before that in Dracula AD 1972 with Johnny Alucard and.
Yeah.
So, as I recall, you know, like I said, I haven't read the story in a while, but I remember this movie. You know, I saw the movie first, then read the story,
mm-hmm.
and I remember thinking, well, it was actually fairly faithful, especially compared to most Dracula adaptations, where they, you know, liberally change names and mix characters together, and you know everything else. So. The way it starts out, I really like the, you know, it's very atmospheric. It gets you in that Hammer mood right away. You got the old crumbling castle, you got the vampire hunter, and you got a female vampire with lots of cleavage.
Right.
That's
right.
Hammer, you know. So it's like, here we are. We're in a Hammer movie right away. Is it just me or does Baron Hartog look a bit
you
like...
You said that when we were watching it, and you were right. I mean, there is some similarity there.
He looks a bit like Johnny Cash. Mm-hmm. So you got two men in black in there. I had to chop the head off that vampire. I run a steak right through.
Yeah, so
I killed a girl in Styria just to watch her die. Oh, man. So, Douglas Wilmer, who played Hartog, I was looking him up on IMDb. He has this, like a credit back in 2012 on Sherlock, and he's still apparently with us today. And he actually played Sherlock Holmes in a 60s TV series. So he's still around. So I was kind of surprised by that, which was cool because I really liked him in this. The first vampire we see, played by Kirsten Betts, she has a very sheer nightgown
on. Oh my gosh, see-through.
Yeah. It's not leaving much to the imagination, including her trimming practices.
Christopher Dean.
Well, come on. Ow. Hey, they got that commercial where those women are shaving the little bonsai tree.
Yeah,
in front of them. So, I mean, what's, you know, don't be smacking me. So, when we get to the present of the story,
mm-hmm.
Emma and her father just miss the arrival of Marcella and her quote unquote mother.
I kind of wonder though if when you say that, you know, in the short story Emma was attacked Marcella as a young girl.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if they didn't come to that party with the idea of, you know, going home with Emma, not with Laura.
Staying with Spielsdorf?
Yeah, I wonder if it was an accident and she stayed with Laura because that's who was available and they were trying again with Emma, like.
It could be. It could be, yeah.
That, I mean, that she was after Emma the whole time.
I mean, that's the thing. Apparently, you know, that's the thing that she definitely seems to, you know, she bonds with Emma, or bonds with Laura. And then, but as we'll get into it later, she treats the way when Laura, well, we'll go ahead and talk about it now. When Laura dies,
mm-hmm.
she doesn't attempt to take her with her.
No.
Or was that the plan, or... was it just because she, you know, her father, you know, Cushing ran in there, her uncle Cushing ran in there, and the maid and everything, and she wasn't able to take her with her because she shows up and she's the one that pronounces her dead.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
She is dead, you know, and so when the sunlight comes through and then they, you know, they're all freaking out and then they turn around and she's gone. But she didn't attempt to take her like she did with Emma at the end of the film.
See, I think, to me, she was after Emma the whole time.
Well, if you tie it back into the
the
story, yeah. Then, yeah, that makes sense, yeah. The relationship between the Countess, the Man in Black, and Mircalla, Marcella, Carmilla, it's interesting and it's kept intentionally vague. So I think it's open to interpretation on purpose. It seems like the Countess is almost just a human that's in her it's in the Man in Black's thrall, mm-hmm. like Renton is later, like Peridot is later, because she, there's a, the Man in Black's talking to her, and she turns around, and she's like, puts her hand to her head, like she just snapped out of a, you know,
like some kind of stupor,
stupor
yeah.
or something, yeah.
Or she's just received a hypnotic suggestion and it's taken hold.
Right, yeah. So I kind of tend to think she's just like a Renfield type character that's a pawn, mm-hmm. you know, type thing, which is interesting.
So you said that you thought that the Man in Black is Mercala's father, but I kind of wonder if that's the case, because the Baron says he found all of the graves except one.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the
right well
relationship is.
I'm just going by what I know of the next, because Hammer made two more Karnstein movies,
mm-hmm.
and the next one actually has Ingrid Pitt's not in any of them, but the next one actually has Mircalla come back. Somehow. Now, how in the world she come back with her head chopped off? I don't know.
But see, the head was in the coffin with her.
Yeah, they didn't.
And they took the stake out.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah.
So if you apply Hammer logic.
Yeah. Well, and as many times as Christopher Lee was pulverized into dust and come back.
Yeah,
so,
you know,
yeah. Like we said before, you know, you fill up a Play-Doh mold, put the ashes in there, and pour some blood in, and it's like instant Dracula.
Yeah,
you know?
See, there you go.
So. yeah, I'm really not sure. I really need to see Lust for a Vampire and Twins of Evil. But the thing is I try to watch these movies on the cheap, you know.
Right.
And I'm really cheap. I'm really cheap people. I when it comes to things like this, I keep hoping, like, you know, TCM will show it, and where we live out in the sticks, our internet connection is capped and we can't do Netflix and it sucks. So I can't stream these things. And so I have to go buy the DVD.
Right.
And, you know, you go on Amazon, the DVDs of both are like $20 or Blu-rays are $20 a piece or whatever. And I'm just like, I've almost pulled the trigger on it a couple times, but I just keep hoping I'll find it cheaper. You know?
Yeah. Oh,
that's
yeah.
why I haven't seen them. But, and I understand this is, although a lot of people say, people like this one, and then they like the last one, Twins of Evil, because Peter Cushing comes back as a different character, and he's apparently this fanatical witch hunter / you know, vampire hunter character, that he's almost just as bad as the monsters he's after.
Oh, okay.
Which would be an interesting turn for, so kind of like a dark version of Van Helsing, which has me interested in seeing, because it's Peter Cushing too. Now, oddly enough, this is kind of hard to swallow, but Ingrid Pitt was on record saying she didn't feel like that Carmilla was a lesbian character. She cited that she was inhuman and that such labels didn't apply, things like that. But, you know, I call horse manure on that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think she was maybe just saying that because at the time, that would have, you know, raised quite a ruckus. Now, I really don't understand how this movie got released as was back then, honestly.
No.
It really surprises me, honestly, which, you know, I'm not complaining, but I'm just saying it's so surprising.
You're just going to spend this whole episode getting whopped, aren't you?
Well, we made sure we recorded this episode while the kids weren't in the house.
Yeah.
Because normally you can hear our kids in the background and we talk to them back and forth. They're not here right now.
No.
So, but, I mean, you've got the obvious scenes where she comes on to the other women, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and seduces them, and there's a lot of breast touching and kissing involved. And then you've got the fact that she changes into a cat, and the girl, Emma, even says, "The fur was in my mouth," and it's like,
"The cat comes and sits at the foot of my bed, staring, and it reaches out towards me, and I try to scream, but my throat is strangled. And it lies across me, warm and heavy. And I feel its fur in my mouth. And I retch with fear. And then...
And then?
It turns into you, Carmilla.
Me.
And then you embrace me and kiss me. And suddenly everything's all right, and I'm so happy.
I mean, you can, you know, paint a barn red, and, you know, but anyway.
Also, now here's something else, and I don't know if you caught this. Whenever she would bite a man, you know, because she did bite a man, you know, several times. It was always on the neck.
Yeah, she bit Renton and a doctor on the neck, and she bit on the neck.
Well, Laura, she bit on the breast. Mm-hmm. Emma, she bit on the breast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. So, well, you can say she was killing them, so she just went for their jugular and killed them.
Mm.
And with the women, she was, you know, she was trying to change them into a vampire or just feeding on them. Or, I don't know, it was like this connection between, you know, there's always this sensual, this, well, at least since Stoker, there's been this sensual connection with a vampire. And this predates that, so you kind of wonder, this is probably where he got some of that. And then, right, of course, when they adapted into the play, which became the movie, they upped the sensuality angle of it and made him, you know, the continental smoothie.
Right.
You know, Bela Lugosi type, which then became the very smooth Frank Langella type. You know, so you can kind of see the foundation of that here. And so, yeah, she was definitely, you know, she was just killing those guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a means to an end. She was getting rid of them. I've read that Peter Cushing was a last-minute addition to this cast. I think they expanded the general's role when they had Peter Cushing. This was around the time his wife passed away, and apparently him and his wife were just really very, very close, and he loved his wife very much, and I think he was basically, he took this role just to have something to do, yeah. So I think he had to, there was another picture he had to drop out of right around the time. And
had she been ill, or
I can't remember, but yeah, I think so. You kind of wonder too when he does such a I mean, obviously Peter Cushing's a great actor and one of my favorites. But when Laura dies, I mean, he holds her. I mean, he really seems like somebody has just died. I mean, it really feels real
into his heart for that.
It feels real, yeah. So, yeah. You know, you brought this up. While Ingrid Pitt is, of course, incredibly hot, she really doesn't look 24.
No.
Yeah, she was 33 when this film was made. So
I honestly thought she was closer to 40.
Oh, really?
I mean, like, she was a hot 40-year-old, but I was thinking she was closer, you know, because she has wrinkles around her eyes and different stuff like that the makeup didn't hide when they have close-ups on her face. And I thought she was older.
Don't you talk bad about Ingrid Pitt.
I'm just talking. I mean, she looks older than a young 20-year-old.
Well, yeah, she definitely, especially compared to the two girls that she's...
Right, and especially Emma, because yeah. Emma looks like a dewy 19-year-old,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, with big doe eyes. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Getting back to Laura, you know, you wonder, why didn't the doctor fully examine her? I mean,
during that time, it wouldn't have been done.
Oh, really?
No. I mean, they did it over covers and stuff like that because it wasn't considered proper.
Mm.
I mean, you know, during the 1800s, it was health okay. practices. That would have been typical.
You pointed out, though, when he undid her blouse and listened to her heart, it's like...
And see, that wouldn't have happened.
Gratuitous boob shot right
well,
there.
Well, it was a gratuitous boob shot, and the whole point is when he was examining her, it would have been her lady's maid would have been present, and the doctor. They would not have had any other males in the room, even her father. That would not have happened.
Well, I mean, she was dead.
Still wouldn't have happened.
Okay.
Still wouldn't have happened.
Of course, throughout the film, you see a few random victims of Carmilla.
Mm-hmm.
You got the one girl, and for some crazy reason, she was picking apples in the woods at night.
I know. Now, here's an interesting thing, and I don't know if you picked up on that. After she drops her apple basket and the apples go rolling, there's a pause where she gets a little bit ahead. And I think that harkens back to where vampires are supposed to be drawn to pick up things, which is one of the things why you're supposed to put salt out, because they would pick up the grains of salt. And I think that they were trying to say, you know, there was a pause because the person, you know, was picking up those apples. Something spilled. That's in vampire lore that they're supposed to pick up stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That could have been, I mean, it could have been, I think it was probably just more the way they cut it, but yeah, if you can fill it in with that, you know, so.
I'm sticking my tongue out at him right now. He's calling bullshit, but I don't think I'm wrong. And I'm also flipping him a finger, so, you know.
Boy, I'm glad the kids aren't here this time.
Now, on the other thing, you know, that's the woodcutter's wife that died.
Right.
Now, and then you have, I think it was the woodcutter's wife, but anyway, she was an older woman. The other girl when she is attacked, the other girl, and that's the one that ends up being in the funeral procession later, that they show, but it shows her, Carmela's hand reaching out to her, and at first she welcomes her. So I kind of wonder if she hadn't visited her previously. You know, like she was returning to her.
Right. Well, maybe. Yeah. Or, you know, she just had a friendly face, and then she opened her mouth and had those teeth, you know, too. But I don't know. Could be. But see, they didn't give us the backstory of her in the movie. You know,
yeah,
so.
I know.
But you can, I know, it's like if you, it's like anything. If you read the book, you can kind of fill in holes in the movie. So we start spending time with Emma and her father as Carl comes and tells them that, Laura has died, and that, General Spielsdorf is off to see his friend Baron Hartog, which will, of course, come up again later. And then, not long afterwards, the Countess is pulling the same routine again. But this time, Carmela is her niece. And, you know, it's a good thing that, word didn't travel fast back then, because apparently Mr. Morton didn't know the this Countess.
Well, here's what I have a problem with.
Okay.
This is where I pull logic glass.
Okay.
When they first walk into the initial ball, the boys are over there talking, and they're like, oh, they just moved in to the new, that castle. It's only 5 kilometers from here.
Right.
I'm sorry, but back then, gossip, I mean, that really wasn't that far. That would have been a story that was told at night. I don't know how they wouldn't have known that.
Well, the reason that the Mortons were leaving, though, is because they lived far away. They lived farther away than the rest of them, it seemed like. They were, their estate was farther away from the general than this Countess was. What I got from it.
Okay. But I was just kind of, you know.
Yeah. George Cole, that played Roger Morton, he just recently passed away, actually. He was the actor that played young Ebenezer Scrooge in the Alistair Sim version of A Christmas Carol.
Which is your personal favorite.
Which is my personal favorite, and it's the best, so that's why it's my personal favorite. But you were talking about Madeline Smith earlier that plays Emma. She puts across the very naive and sheltered young woman bit, but sometimes it comes across as just, she's a little too wide-eyed and a little too... You know, there's some couple faces she makes in this movie that are just like...
Well, like when Carmela goes down on her. And right. You're just like...
Well, she goes down on her chest anyway. We don't know how far she goes down on her. We see her, you know, messing around with her chest, but...
Yeah, but come on. You and I both know what was going on down there.
Well, the look on her face, like, yeah, you're probably not wrong. Anyway, Madeline Smith would go on to be in Live and Let Die with Roger Moore's James Bond, so, which is my personal favorite Roger Moore movie, James Bond movie.
You changed the subject, didn't you?
Well, now we're going to get back into it because we have to talk about the gratuitous bath scene.
Who is it?
It's me, Emma.
Oh, do come in.
Those dresses, aren't they beautiful?
You may wear one if you want to.
May I really?
Emma, hand me that towel over there, please.
Yes.
Thank you. Your dress is very pretty, but it's for a country girl. In town, you must be more sophisticated. You must take everything off. Try it once.
Oh. All right.
You can't put it over a bodice. It ruins the shape.
I've never worn anything like this. I feel so daring. What did my father say?
Oh, he will appreciate it like all men. But I think it will be too big.
It's not. I'm sure it's not. I'll show you. Look, Carmela.
What did I tell you? Take the other dress I have.
No.
It's too small for me.
No, I don't
yes,
want
Yes, you must.
Take the other dress.
I want you to. I want you to.
No.
I say, take the other dress.
No.
Yes.
No.
That's all that was.
This famous, you know, she walks in the door, Emma walks in the door, and Ingrid Pitt is naked in a bath, in a clawfoot bathtub, with her chest above the water. And then she steps out, and there's her rear end right in the camera. And,
oh, yeah.
And she puts a towel on, Emma hands her a towel, but she just puts it around her waist. So that way she'll be topless for the rest of the scene. This is where Hammer ventures into the soft core territory right here. I mean, it's...
Venture? He rode that horse galloping in there.
And then Emma tries on one of Carmela's dresses.
Yeah.
And they chase each other around the room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty... Yeah. Dear Penthouse. You know, it's like... I mean, that's what it is. It's like male fantasy... Naked girls chasing each other around a room and frolicking on the bed. I mean, that's basically what it amounts to.
You're a pig.
I'm not saying me. I'm saying the male zeitgeist. I mean, there you go.
Anyway.
And Emma starts having the dreams. But the visual that we're shown is she's dreaming of Laura having the dream.
I know.
She sees Laura in the dream. Which is like, was that just them being cheap reusing the same footage? Or was there some kind of psychic link?
Of past victims.
Of past victims. Yeah, yeah. It's like, it was really kind of strange. And one thing, we watched the trailer for this on the DVD. And when they showed both Laura and Emma having this dream, there would be some kind of a blurry gray effect on it.
Mm-hmm.
As if it was like through some kind of weird filter. And so all you saw was this furry mass, like, undulating on her bed. Don't laugh. We're going to have a hard time getting through this one. But that's in the film itself. But now when we saw the trailer, as trailers often do, they show you the unedited version of scenes.
Uh-huh.
And they showed that scene filmed through a normal lens, as the rest of the movie is.
Right.
And it looked really bad, because it looked like she had a big fur cover just going over top of her. It looks a lot better. Whoever decided, we need to put some kind of effect on that.
Yeah.
Was smart.
Yeah.
Because it worked. But yeah, she had the... Their dreams were connected, which was weird. We get to see Mademoiselle Peridot, who is played by Kate O'Mara, who Doctor Who fans know... go on to play the Ronnie during the mid-80s version of Doctor Who.
Right.
So, and she passed away not too long ago as well. Carmela don't want Emma talking about no man.
No.
She brings up Carl and she's like, I want you always, you know.
I know. With me always.
Yeah, she's like, but it's different. She's just like, not to me it ain't, basically, you know. Exhibit C, you know. For the lesbian thing. On a more serious note, I do like the scene with the funeral procession, because there's several moments through this where you sympathize with Ingrid Pitt.
Stop it! Stop it!
Carmela, what is it?
Nothing. Only that dreadful noise.
The funeral? But it's the woodman's daughter.
I hate funerals. Hate them!
I thought it rather sad, and yet beautiful.
You must die. Everybody must die.
But you were so young. There's been so much tragedy in the village recently.
The blacksmith's young wife died only last week. My father said... Oh, you really are upset, Carmilla. And I've been saying all these foolish things. Come on, let's go home. Carmilla.
Hold me. I beg you, hold me tight.
Because you get the idea that she does not like what she is. You know, she regrets doing what she has to do to the one she loves.
Right.
She really does love them, but it's like, I love you, but this is how I love you. But now the one she just kills, you know, she's a monster.
Right.
But, you know, very upset that it, you know, the chanting, they put a nice echo effect on it. It's like it hurts her, you know, because it's a religious chant as they're walking by the funeral procession. And, you know, I thought that was nice. You know, sympathetic vampires are kind of cliche now, but she might have been one of the first ones on film that you really kind of felt sorry for, because up to that point there was no version of Dracula that was very sympathetic. I guess maybe Dracula's daughter, now that I think about it, the Universal movie, she didn't want to be a vampire either, but, you know, again, you're getting into a female vampire, so maybe it's, when it's a female vampire, it's the softer side of vampirism.
She's not supposed to want to be evil.
Right, exactly. Not too long after that, Carmilla converts Mademoiselle Peridot to the home team. You know, if anybody can do it, Ingrid Pitt. Good, right. Right. So. Yeah, I can't help but think every time I first saw this movie, the guy that plays Renton looks like David Gilmour from Pink Floyd. It bothers me every time.
I kind of think it's interesting that you have Renton in this story. Now, was this his name in the short story as well?
I don't remember.
Because that seems awfully close to Renfield. Mm. Both good men that were turned by a vampire to help them.
Could be. That's true. I didn't think about that. Yeah. Yeah, of course he doesn't. He helps out early on, but it doesn't take long before he's.
Well, you know. I mean, you put a bit set of tits in front of a man's face, and he's going, okay.
I put an explicit tag on this episode. Jeez.
His brain turned to broccoli. Gonna have to cut part of this out.
I do like the wrinkle that Renton and the doctor think that Peridot is the vampire.
Yeah,
that's nice, because she backs away from the garlic flowers and you know, she locks herself in her room and stays there after all that.
And Renton checks in on her, and she's
writhing in her bed, because she's, you know, like she's in between vampirism and humanism.
Right.
Humanity.
And Renton says to her, oh, she's a wicked woman, to Carmilla.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Peridot is a wicked woman. And,
right.
You know.
And she's like, you mean, you know, they don't even say the word, but she's, and then that's when she, you know, snuggles in close to him, like, hold me. And then she, you know, starts putting the moves on him.
But it's funny. I mean, her body language, if you watch it, her body language with him is different than her body language with any of the women. Because...
Right.
She is there, but she's not into it.
Right.
She's holding herself more erect away from him. I mean, she's just as close. She's just as close as what she needs to be, but not snuggled in.
Right. Well, that's good acting. I mean, I really do think Ingrid Pitt, I mean, you know, obviously Ingrid Pitt, you watch this movie, you know, it's got its obvious visual attributes to it. But, I mean, she does a really good job in it, and she plays a really good character. I mean, beside all that, beside the exploitative nature of some of the elements of it. And Hammer, of course, knew how to create a great vampire hunter. I really do like Wilmer as Baron Hartog, especially as an older man, who looks like an older Johnny Cash, by the way. You know, he could fit right in with, of course, my favorite Cushing as Van Helsing. There's Brother Sandor from Dracula, Prince of Darkness, also a good vampire hunter. And then there's Captain Kronos, vampire hunter, which is an awesome movie. But anyway, now it shows Hartog staking the vampires, But he takes the stake out.
Right, like, which is what I said.
Yeah, you know? I know. It's like he jams it in there, and he just like pulls it back out. It's like, dude, I mean, because that's vampire lore that you leave it in there. That's not from a movie. They stake, I mean, they really did stake people.
I know.
They thought they were vampires. I mean, that's not myth. They staked people who, you know, if a body, you know, they
didn't seem to decay quick enough.
Or they heard moaning and groaning because of gases released from a body or something. Right. They would stake them. Or if somebody said, I saw so-and-so out walking around, you know, they're supposed to be dead. And they dig up a poor dead body and stake them. And do all,
behead them. Yeah.
Behead them and do all sorts of horrible things to them. So, I mean, that part's not even open for debate. That's bad vampire hunting on his part. But I like him anyway. The only thing that kind of kills it is when there's one male vampire. And when he stabs him, his scream's dubbed in pretty badly.
Yeah, it's like off track.
It's
or
off
something.
Track. It's like
yeah.
This is a Japanese vampire movie or something. You know? I've seen that one. I've seen that Hammer movie.
Oh, that was...
We should do that one.
No.
Dracula and the Seven Golden Vampires.
No. You made me... I fell asleep on purpose. I'm only like knocking myself in the head to go to sleep during that one.
Oddly enough, because Christopher Lee took one look at that script and said, this is shit, you know, and wouldn't do it. John Forbes Robertson, who played the Man in Black, plays Dracula in that.
Mm.
So he's the fill-in Christopher Lee in that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so... There's your connection there. Poor Renton, like we said, if he only knew that Carmilla didn't swing that way,
yeah.
He'd been a lot better off. You know, like you said, it was just all an act. So, I was reading on IMDb. There wasn't a whole lot on this movie on IMDb, but apparently, you know, at the end, Carmilla is taking Emma down the stairs, and Madame Peridot comes out and says, "Take me with you," and so she comes, she stalks back up the stairs and grabs a hold of her like she's going to embrace her, and then just, you know, shows her fangs and bites her.
I know.
And she screams. But apparently they had to shoot that thing over and over because Ingrid Pitt's fangs kept falling out into her cleavage, into Kate O'Mara's cleavage. And she finally stuck them in with, like, chewing gum. So that's, the idea of that's just hilarious. And apparently they kept cracking up, obviously. Like we said last year when we were talking about Hammer movies, the difference between the Hammer films and the modern films that kind of took over immediately after them, the same kind of horror films you get today, is that you really did get that good will conquer evil. I mean, the evil might, they'll get a bunch of wins throughout the movie, but...
Right, but like, in the end...
Yeah, like when Carl pulls the dagger out of his boot,
right.
And he uses it as a cross and then, you know, throws it out. That's a cool effect too when she disappears. So, I like that.
I do have a problem with that.
What's
because
that?
She takes her necklace with her there, mm-hmm. You know, when she disappears. But when she disappears into her crypt at the end, her necklace is left on the floor. Why?
Mm. Well, it just fell off.
Why?
I guess. I don't know.
Why?
I don't know.
Why?
Because they needed to be able to find out where her grave was.
Why?
Because they needed to end the movie.
It doesn't make any sense that the necklace would disappear with her in that instance, but it wouldn't disappear with her when she went into the crypt.
I don't know. She had that thing on through the whole movie. That ruby
I know,
necklace.
But
yeah.
Why?
I don't know. Why are you asking me? Call up Tudor.
It's my job.
Tudor Gates and whoever, Michael Stiles and whoever the hell else wrote this
it's
movie.
It's my job.
It's your job. That's what you get paid for here.
That's right.
If you're going to kill a vampire, let Peter Cushing do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just, you know, he'd get the damn job done. It's right.
But
he killed a guy with the shadow of a windmill making a cross once, okay?
But here's the thing about vampire lore, and you have to remember this.
Peter Cushing kicks their ass. That's the thing about
Carl was able to use the dagger, even though it wasn't an actual cross, because he was righteous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole thing. And, I mean, if you go through vampire lore... You have to believe it. You have to actually hold it in your heart that you are righteous in order to use the symbol
right.
of the cross. And they will tell you that, you know, in other vampire lore, if you are an evil person and you're trying to ward off a vampire with a cross, it's not going to work.
Well, or if you don't believe, like, I've seen one thing where, like, somebody, like a Jewish character used the Star of David and repelled a vampire.
Oh, okay.
So it's got to be something, you know, that... that they believe in, you know. So, but what are you going to say about the doctor that you're going to bring up? That the fact that the doctor, when he was attacked.
Right. Because he was a man of science.
The doctor, when the doctor is attacked out in the woods by Carmilla, he's thrown off his horse. She attacks him. And as he's trying to fight her off, he takes a stick and he's drawing a cross in the dirt. But she still attacks him. Mm-hmm. It doesn't ward her off. So, I don't know if... Then the wind kind of blows it away.
I know. That was
so maybe that's what it was. But it kind of like... They should have had the wind blow it away. Then it wasn't... If that's what it was supposed to be, they should have cut it a little different.
Yeah.
But like you said, maybe he didn't really believe in it. And maybe he was casting about in his last seconds.
Well, and the other thing, too, is during the whole thing with Emma, when he said, you know... It was Renton who brought the garlic flowers in. It wasn't the doctor who
But he went over and got the cross out of her jewelry box.
But, what I'm, you didn't let me finish.
I'm sorry.
But he was like, well, you know, it might not work, but why not go ahead and try? You know, he thought it was, oh, superstitious, blah, blah, blah. You know, there was still that doubt in his mind. Yes, he was a man of science, but there was also room for doubt, which is also why he tried to draw a cross at the end.
Could be.
But he didn't really... He didn't really, really believe it, so it didn't work.
Yeah. Could be. Peter Cushing stakes her and then decapitates her, and the head's not the best looking. It's I've seen worse.
Yeah, I've seen better, but I've seen better. Worse. Yeah,
it's not, The man in black watches as they move her coffin into the proper tomb, and he looks pissed. But like we said, apparently he returns in the sequels, so, you know, they're... And at some point he's called, I'm pretty sure he's called Count Karnstein in the credits. So I don't know what that means. He might be an ancestor of him rather than her father. I don't know.
See, I'm just, because that whole, the whole line when he said he staked all.
Well, maybe he wasn't, you know, I don't know. She keeps coming back apparently, so.
Well, yeah.
And if he didn't leave the freaking stake in there, then yes.
True.
Then there's the whole portrait aging thing.
That. Just didn't work for me.
It didn't fit in with it. Yeah, it was kind of, I think it was too Dorian Gray like.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was just kind of added in. It was kind of a nice little visual hook at the end, but at the same time it was like, okay, there's enough ambiguous weirdness going on that you haven't explained without throwing that.
Like her necklace not disappearing with her. Not going to let that go, by the way.
No. So, right after this, Ingrid Pitt appeared in Hammer's Countess Dracula, where she played Elizabeth Bathory.
Right.
A very fictionalized version of the account of Elizabeth Bathory. But, you know, I mean, because she actually does get younger as she bathes in blood. You know, she goes from wrinkled makeup old woman to, you know...
Ingrid Pitt.
So, which, but it's still a good movie. And actually, I've got that on a double feature, the same DVD set that Vampire Lovers is on. They came together. And she is also in one of the vignettes in The House That Dripped Blood, which is an anthology film that's actually by Amicus, but it's got, which is another English studio, but it's got Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and Ingrid Pitt in it, and John Pertwee for another Doctor Who connection.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I like that quite a bit. And I really like this film. It is one of my favorite Hammer films. It's one of my favorite vampire films. You know, I've gone on record as saying I'm not too big on making Dracula overly sympathetic, which is why I like Christopher Lee, because he's just a Dracula, because he's just an evil bastard. But I have no problem with taking another vampire character and making him sympathetic. Right. This has kind of a nice, there's basically two eras of Hammer horror. There's the classic late 50s, the early 60s Hammer that, you know, the very bright Technicolor, lots of very red blood, no, you know, there's sexual innuendo here and there, lots of cleavage, but there's no nudity.
Right.
And then there's the 70s Hammer where there's, you know, bare boobs everywhere. And this is kind of, even though there's a lot of suggestive stuff, and they're not even, it's not even suggesting it, it's just showing it to you, stuff in this film. It's got that feel of the earlier Hammer films. It's got the production values beyond the budget. You know, they spent $5, but it looks like $100, you know.
The only thing where they, I think they messed up, and you and I talked about this at the time, the green dress that Carmilla wears twice during the film, it's way too 70s.
Yeah, it looks too modern.
Yeah. Really, that's the only thing that...
It looks like a, kind of like Captain Kirk's green wraparound tunic. think about it.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's Shatner's belly shirt on Ingrid Pitt. But yeah, we really got a kick out of this. I like the score. Harry Robertson did the score. There's parts of it that sounded a little bit like Dark Shadows, mm-hmm. which was, of course, very popular at the time.
The only part where I think it stepped out of what would be appropriate is when she attacks the doctor and it's too, you know.
Too psycho.
Too psycho. The musical score doesn't fit the time period to me for that part when she attacks the doctor.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's too jarring.
I could see that. Well, is that all we got on this one?
I think so.
Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll dive into our comic book, our dusty comic long box in the House of Frankenstein, and we'll discuss another female vampire who runs afoul of Superman and Batman.
Mm-hmm. Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, wasn't that an 80s cop show on ABC with David Raich?
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Down Place can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that was Sledgehammer.
1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
Okay, we're back, and now we're going to go through the dusty long boxes in the House of Frankenstein and pull out a comic that is related to the movie we just discussed. This one leapt out right at me. It's like, female vampire. It's like, what could we do? And then, so it's like, bing, this one. So we're going to talk about Action Comics Annual Number 1 from 1987. According to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, it was on sale July 7th, 1987. The cover art is by Art Adams and Dick Giordano, and it shows Superman hovering, landing, with Batman crouched before him. Behind them are images of two bats and the text, "Cry, Vampire." The story, Skeeter, was written by John Byrne, penciled by Art Adams, inked by Dick Giordano, lettered by Albert de Guzman, colored by Petra Scotis, and edited by Mike Carlin. Superman, created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Batman, created by Bob Kane and Bill Finger, damn it.
A dark swamp outside of Fayetteville, South Carolina. A shadowy pitchfork and torch-wielding mob chase a young, buxom girl through the swamp. The pursuers call out to the girl with long, frizzy blonde hair clad in cut-off Daisy Duke shorts and a Mr. Peanut t-shirt. They call her Skeeter.
Skeeter ventures deeper into the swamp to make her escape, only to find herself back home. She shows herself to the mob in order to lead them away from her cabin and her mammy and paw. She then dives into the swamp, and the mob realizes they have lost her, as dawn is fast approaching. Her enemies gone, and exhausted and hungry Skeeter crawls back home. There she laments her situation, how she should have never left home despite her parents' insistence on her going to the big city. How the only education she got was when she came home to find her parents in their current state as dried up corpses.
3 days later, and two strangers arrive in Fayetteville. One, a woman named Miss Carson, whose car broke down on the freeway, and another, known only as Mr. Smith, who was nice enough to give her a lift. Miss Carson goes in search of a mechanic, while Mr. Smith hits the local diner. When he chats up a waitress and asks her about a good hotel, the southern hospitality suddenly turns chilly. That night, despite the protest of the desk clerk, Smith checks into a motel in town. He then sheds his clothes in disguise and assumes his true identity of the Batman.
Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, 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 dun.
I love you. Skulking about the rooftops, Batman observes the townspeople shuffling about in groups, and then hears a woman scream. In a nearby alley, he is horrified to find Miss Carson with her throat ripped out, just like in Gotham, just like the others, he thinks. He is soon surrounded by armed locals who utter, "He's one of them!" Thanks to a well-placed smoke bomb, he makes his escape without injuring anyone.
Alone on a rooftop, a tired Batman remembers the beginnings of this case. Now Commissioner Gordon called him in, feeling this case was out of his realm of expertise. He remembers the first victim he found and the trail he followed from Gotham to Fayerville. He also realizes he's going to need some help. In the Metropolis offices of the Daily Planet, Clark Kent receives a call from someone claiming to be the Batman. He wants Kent to get in touch with Superman. The matter at hand involves mass murder. To prove his veracity, Batman says one word, magpie. Kent, secretly Superman, knows only the real Batman would be aware of their joint venture in apprehending the female criminal of the same name. Making his usual dramatic change, the Man of Steel flies for South Carolina.
Back in Fayerville, Batman runs into Skeeter, who, much to his chagrin, isn't afraid of him at all. Skeeter rambles about how her mammy and pa said someone would come to help her. She hugs a flummoxed Batman, feeling he is there to save her.
Elsewhere in town, Superman arrives and with his X-ray vision notices that the town is very active for such a late hour. Crowds roam the streets and whole families sit up scared and awake in their homes. He visits the local sheriff's office asking if Batman has been in contact. The sheriff tells him no and assures this squeamish deputy that this is indeed the real Superman, and it sure as hell ain't no vampire.
Skeeter leads Batman to her home. The Dark Knight notes that the house looks as if it hadn't been lived in for years. As he enters, he smells the stench of death and soon finds out why. Shocked at the sight of Skeeter's decaying parents, he blurts out, "Good Lord!" Skeeter's demeanor changes immediately. As Batman puzzles out what he has stumbled onto, Skeeter rambles on about how Batman shouldn't be able to say,
"The name! The holy name!"
The sheriff takes Superman to the local hospital. There he finds a guarded ward with boarded up windows. Inside, the gruesome sight he sees shocks even the Man of Steel.
Back in her family cabin, Skeeter is now convinced Batman is not who she thought he was. "You said the name. You ain't who I thought you were, are you? You ain't anything like who I thought you were."
"She's doing something. Doing something to me. Head. Thoughts. Fuzzy. Hot. Feels like oven here. Body feels like ton weight."
"You're one of them. You're one of the others."
"Hardly see straight. Losing it. Got to move. Only few seconds."
Batman leaps from the window, only to land in a bog of quicksand below. As he sinks out of sight, Skeeter thinks that no one is going to come help her. She's going to have to do this on her own. As the sheriff and Superman discuss the situation, the patients in the guarded ward escape through iron bars. Superman flies off to stop them as the sheriff finally takes the town's problems public by calling the National Guard. On the edge of town, surrounded by bats, a wicked-looking Skeeter calls for her children to rise up. Flying above them as the mindless army attacks the town, Superman recalls basic vampire lore and surmises that while they are enslaved to their master, they are not yet undead. He can still save them and so goes about containing them by building a brick wall from the rubble left in the wake of their destruction.
The trick works, but now the Man of Tomorrow must face their master. He turns to find Skeeter, whose formerly soft features transform into something hideous.
"Superman!"
"Let me guess, you'd be the hostess of this little danse macabre."
"I'm Ellie Mae Skaggs, Superman, but folks around here call me Skeeter."
Her eyes. Feels like she's stirring my brain with an ice pick. "Sorry, Skeeter, I don't think your tricks are gonna work on me." My chest. She tore right through my costume, right through the electrochemical aura that surrounds my body. Of course, she's a vampire. She's supernatural. Magical, and I'm vulnerable to magic.
Superman strikes an attacking Skeeter, but soon she's on top of him, her fangs bared and her eyes breaking his powerful will. She beckons him to join her in eternal life for only an instant of pain.
As her fangs near his near-indestructible neck, a wooden stake penetrates her chest. From behind, Batman stands, long stake in hand, as he lifts Skeeter's impaled body off of the Man of Steel. As she begins to decay, an incredulous Skeeter asks how he survived. The always prepared Cape Crusader informs her one can swim in quicksand if he doesn't panic. With Skeeter now a lifeless and aged skeleton, Superman tells Batman, "I owe you my life." The sardonic Dark Knight points out, "I don't much fancy the idea of a super vampire flying around." He then tells his partner in crime to get those wounds cleaned with holy water.
6 hours later, the Batman has returned to Gotham City. At a local cemetery, he stands before several unearthed graves as he informs Commissioner Gordon that Ellie Mae Skaggs was no little girl. She was born shortly after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. He surmises her and her parents became vampires over 100 years ago. Gordon comments that now it's all over, but the Batman cautions,
"Not quite. One last thing to do before night falls."
As he clutches a mallet and a handful of wooden stakes, he solemnly says,
"You and your men are free to leave if you don't feel like watching." I love that book. I think, if I'm correct, this was the first post-crisis team-up of Superman and Batman outside of Man of Steel number 3, which told how they first met post-crisis. Mm-hmm. They had been in a few other comics together, like Legends and things like that, but this was the first World's Finest type story since Man of Steel number 3, and that's, of course, where they fought Magpie. And this post-crisis Superman-Batman team wasn't much of a team. It no doubt keyed off Frank Miller's take on them in The Dark Knight, but their relationship had kind of become strained a few years prior to World's Finest, and then they buried the hatchet. They basically had a falling out when Batman formed the Outsiders and quit the Justice League, but they kind of buried the hatchet. But then in the last issue of World's Finest, I guess because they knew how things were going to be post-crisis, mm-hmm. they kind of were at odds in that issue as Superman flew away. So, you know, when they hit the reset button finally for Superman, they established their philosophical differences. And so this is one of the first times, if not the first time in the current time, that you saw Superman and Batman interacting. So this was a big deal when it came out.
Gotcha.
And Action at this time was the Superman team-up title. When Byrne had rebooted the Superman books, Action took the place of DC Comics Presents and was the team-up book. So this is annual number 1, so what better way to have an annual,
right,
you know,
right,
big deal than have Batman be the guest star. Now, one thing I want to ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
If you had read this story cold and had not seen the cover, and I know you've read this story before,
because right,
I've
right.
been, you know, it's always been a favorite of mine, but if you hadn't seen the cover that says Cry Vampire on it, even with just the bats and no Cry Vampire, you could almost say, well, the bats are on the cover because Batman's in this Superman comic.
Right.
But if it didn't say Cry Vampire on it, do you think it would have worked better?
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things, you get telegraphed the ending before you get into it. So you kind of like, it's kind of like when you read a mystery and you already know who the killer is.
Right.
You're looking for these clues all along the way. It kind of takes some of the surprise out of it.
I mean, I guess the way Byrne sets this up, I mean, when the story starts, you're not, I mean, Skeeter is being chased through the swamp. The way that Art Adams draws the mob chasing her, they look monstrous.
Right.
I mean, one of the guys even kind of looks like a werewolf. And I mean, of course, usually monsters don't chase people with torches, but they look scary and she doesn't.
Uh-huh.
So I think Byrne was trying to
Make you think that they were the town of vampires chasing the one lone human.
Right, exactly. And especially when she finds the parents the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
Look what they did to you, you know. If the cover didn't say Cry Vampire on it, you know, which I mean, I guess it could still work that way. I mean, if you know, but if it didn't tell you vampire on the cover, you might wonder what's going on
right. Completely.
I think this is a case where, but on the other hand, vampire stories sell.
True.
And they wanted to they wanted to, you
ensure
know,
sales.
Ensure sales by putting, but I think any comic with Superman and Batman in it, especially at this period when it was no longer a common monthly occurrence, was going to sell.
Right.
Of course, Art Adams sure knows how to draw a fetching young woman. Right. With her little,
like you said, buxom.
Well, she's definitely buxom. Her Daisy Duke shorts and Mr. Peanut t-shirt. So, one question I have. Mm-hmm. Skeeter leads the mob away from her parents. I'm kind of confused by this because she says, you know, what they did to her, to them while she was gone.
Uh-huh.
So, if the town didn't, I'm assuming we never see them impaled or we don't see a stake through them. We don't, but apparently somebody destroyed them in the manner that you destroy a vampire.
I kind of got the feeling that, you know, something happened that she thought she could get help for them and restore them, you know, because they didn't have a stake through them. And I think she thought Batman was coming to help her restore her parents. That's what I got out of it.
Well, it could be, but it's like if she led the townspeople away from the bodies, so that makes me think they didn't do it, or they would know. You know, they would have went to the cabin, seeing if she was coming back.
Right, right.
They could have stayed. They could have went to the cabin during the daytime and took her out if they knew where she came from.
Well, see, I think that's the whole point. You know, like, you know, how did the townsfolk not know about her and blah, blah, blah? I think they lived back in the swamp.
Uh-huh.
And maybe she had just recently, they had just recently ventured into the town.
Yeah.
I don't think that the town knew she was there until, like, maybe, say, 6 months before or something like that. That's what I got out of that.
Well, it almost makes me think that the townspeople in Fayerville, apparently, I mean, because she had lived there her whole life because her birth certificate's in the town hall.
Right.
That's how Batman finds out she was born the day Abraham Lincoln was assassinated or whatever. Right. But, so the townspeople, I'm guessing her family victimized the town for a century. But it was here and there, and they were quiet about it. But somebody, I'm guessing just the way this is written, from outside the town, took her parents out. Or why would she lead them away? You know what I'm saying? Because if the townspeople had...
It's a plot hole.
I don't know if it's a plot hole or it's just... It's trying to do exactly what you and me are doing right now. To, you know, try to come up with it on our own and fill in the blank or something.
But see, it doesn't... I mean, you can either say they were there, you know... And they wanted her to go to the big city to get an education. But the timeline, you know, why are her parents in the state that they're in?
Right.
I just...
Oh, that's kind of always been a little odd, the thing with her parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was more of a... It might have just been like, this would be a real creepy moment, and it'll throw you off. You know, it'll throw you off a little bit more.
It's not, you know...
Yeah. But I think it... Plus, when you see their... Another weird thing about her parents... is when you see their corpses, they don't have fangs.
Right.
But now when she starts to crumble into a skeleton, she's got fangs, and usually in most vampire movies and things.
Well, but here's the thing. She was staked while she was in her vampire form, which leads me to think that they came up to them.
Yeah.
But then again, they're sitting in a chair.
Right.
So...
We don't know. There could be a stake running through them, and they just didn't want to ruin the ending where Batman runs her through. You know, they didn't want to lose the impact.
But the thing is their bodies are still there where hers has goes down to a skeleton.
That's true, too. They just look like mummified.
Mummified, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
I don't know. It's just kind of strange. With his glasses, when he comes into town, you could almost wonder if Mr. Smith isn't Superman in disguise.
See, I thought it was at first because he's like, well, you get the lay of the land by going to the local diner, and that's, you know, your first thing as a reporter.
Right.
You know, I thought it was Superman because, you know, the whole blue eyes, black hair deal.
Well, and yeah, if you're a comic book hero, you got blue eyes, black hair. But yeah, and plus, you know, Batman fits it in so well. It's interesting to think that Batman has more social skills when he's acting than he does in real life,
you know,
because he's fitting in right in with these local yokels. And you could see, you know, Superman would because he's a small town guy,
he's
a small town kid. So you could kind of see him fitting in better, but Batman's just a good actor, I guess. Plus, disguise isn't Superman shtick, but
right.
But he's definitely more chummy with the townspeople than he is with Superman in this story. It's easy to see that this book came out not long after The Dark Knight Returns, because Art Adams' Batman is very Frank Miller-like. He's a big hulking figure.
He's a big hulking figure of a man.
He's a big bulging beast of a man in a blue leisure suit. Batman is Cousin Eddie. The one thing that's always bothered me about this, and I know this is, you know, on a podcast, it's hard to see, but if you have this comic, and I don't know, I think this was reprinted. I should have looked that up, but I think they reprinted this, and they finally did a trade of The Dark Knight Over Metropolis, and they put this in the beginning to pad it out. Dark Knight Over Metropolis was the first, another early Superman-Batman team-up that happened in the Superman books, which was a good storyline. But I don't know if this is repeated there, but the colorist, Petra Skotis, keeps, I think it's a mistake, because around Art Adams would leave, his cowl, Batman's cowl would be mostly black, but he'd have, like, a white area in his pencils and inks, or Dick Giordano's inks, around his eyes. Of course, Batman's eyes are all white, but she would color them in that area around his eye flesh color. I think it should have been blue, because it looks really weird that Batman's got, like, an opening in it. He's got openings around his eyes, like, say, like The Flash or Captain America does, but his eyes are, like, white. It's, like, really weird, you know? It's, like, it just looks strange. I think they were supposed to be colored in blue, and that's always bothered me. It's just downright creepy looking, so.
Well, but maybe it just fit the theme of the story.
Maybe, maybe. One, another question. Now, Miss Carson, that Batman gives a ride.
And I wonder if Batman feels guilty, because that's the town that he brought her to. He brought her to her death.
Yeah, well, he couldn't have just dropped her off somewhere else, right? Miss Carson and the victim in Gotham we see, and the others, as Batman mentions, were DEAD dead.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming they will return as vampires if they're not properly, their bodies aren't properly treated. But we'll put a pin in that for later when we get to that. But yeah. And not only does Batman look very Miller-like, but Adams, Clark Kent, and Superman borrow quite a bit from Frank Miller. Especially you get silhouetted shots of Superman as he's leaving the Daily Planet. That looks a lot like when in The Dark Knight where Superman's fighting like the Russian army and stuff. And he's got the big floppy curl that Miller gives Superman as well. So I think The Dark Knight Returns with a big influence on Art Adams in this, but
I don't know. Whenever I see that Superman with the S curl, I always think of John Travolta in Grease when he does his hair. Grease, like, does he do that real quick?
Yeah, at super speed.
Yeah, takes a little grease lightning and does that little curl.
Go grease lightning, you're burning up a coat of mine.
I just kind of wonder because I.
Don't mess with my hair. That's wrong movie. Wrong John Travolta movie, but you know. As a kid, when I read this came out in 87, summer of 87, so I was, how old was I? I was like 12 years old. I assumed that Skeeter thought Batman was Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
If not Dracula, then at least a master vampire. But in my kid mind, it's like, she thinks he's Dracula.
Yes.
So. Of course, the deputy is no doubt meant to remind us of Barney Fife.
His name's Donnie, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, hello, Don Knotts, Donnie.
Yeah.
I mean, he's Barney Fife. That's a big duh moment.
You sure this is Superman, Ange? I don't know. I saw Superman once when I was over at Mount Pilot. We got to nip these vampires in the bud. Nip them in the bud. The sheriff has a sharpened stick in his desk per Superman's X-ray vision. Yeah. I always thought it odd that when Batman said, good Lord, he called it an oath. I don't think I've ever heard that mentioned. He says something like, she was offended by my oath or something. I've never heard saying that, called that before. I just thought that was kind of an odd.
Oh, I have. In Regency writing and things like that, it's, you know.
Oh, okay.
You took an oath, you know, like, you took the Lord's name in vain. You shouldn't say that oath. You know.
Oh, okay. Well, I always think of, you know.
And now this obviously isn't in vain, but, you know.
Right. That, yeah. So
yeah, that's common.
Okay, well, I guess that's for what I get for growing up reading comics. I think an oath is in Brightest Day and Blackest Night, you know that.
Yeah. But no.
Okay, here's the part. This is the part we put the pin in for later.
Mm-hmm.
So the Terror Ward, as Superman calls it, which I think is interesting, is it full of vampire bite victims who aren't yet dead? Because that's the way it seems later, because Superman says they haven't died yet.
Right, he can still save them.
He can still save them. I wonder if this wasn't some editorial interference along the way, and that they were originally supposed to be vampires. Because the look on Superman's face when he...
Right.
I mean, there's this panel with no text, that's just Superman's horrified face as his head slings back. It's like, oh, you know. And... if they were just bite victims in there, I don't know why he would be so shocked, you know.
Right.
But so, and I wonder if somebody at some point said, okay, we got way too many dead people in this comic, you know, too many.
Right.
Too many.
And you have to think it's a small town.
Right.
Would they have that many, would there be enough population to have that many dead, you know, vampires that she'd attacked and they still be, you know, I just kind of.
Right, right. Yeah, it just seemed like it. That part seemed a little incongruous because they have the strength of a vampire because they're ripping out through steel bars or turning cars over.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, in some stories, the person that's in the vampire's thrall has some of their powers.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It seemed. I just wonder because they looked like the Walking Dead, you know. I mean,
yeah.
When they were coming through,
But maybe, you know, in some stories I've also seen, to become a vampire, you know, it takes 3 days, and during that time,
yeah,
you have some of the symptoms and powers and, you know,
yeah,
all that stuff.
That's
so
true, too. Yeah.
And it said, you know, she had gone to get an education to the big city.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you think about it, if she had started when she came back, started biting townsfolk, it took Batman 3 days to get there. This would be the third day.
Yeah, could be. But I wonder if it could have been written like that on purpose, but it also makes me wonder if it wasn't at some point somebody said, okay, this is getting a little too dark for a,
yeah,
you know, nowadays they wouldn't worry about anything like that. But, so Batman falls into the quicksand, and here the art, it looks a lot like David Mazzucchelli's art from Batman Year One, when Bruce Wayne jumps into the muddy river to save Gordon's baby.
Mm.
I mean, it looks the mud and everything. So it's like, and Batman Year One had ended a few months before this. So it makes me think, you know, Art Adams was really on a Miller kick at this point, which, you know, I do like that Superman, you know, his solution to corralling the vampires, you know, taking the rubble and building the wall around
right.
them. That's classic Superman.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You can just hear the John Williams score kick in when he's flying around at super speed doing that. You know, that's cool.
Yeah, and he has hard air. And I'm like...
Oh.
Slaps palm to forehead.
Yeah.
Mm.
Burns trying to over-explain stuff, which we'll get to later, but he's got hard air, you know,
yeah,
a wall of hard
what?
Air. Yeah.
Hold on, let's see what we call it exactly. Let's see. Step 2, set up a wall of hard air around them to dissuade them from going any farther. And I love how at least they all have underwear on.
Yeah.
I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. I wonder if that wasn't drawn in later, too.
You know.
Dick Giordano, you know, of course, was one of the VPs of DC at this time, and he's inking this. He's probably like, oh, we're not going to have any bare butts in this. This is a new Stan comic, you know.
Uh-huh.
Draw some underwear on these people. Wouldn't surprise me. Is it just me or does Superman look a bit like Bruce Campbell here? He's got the chin, you know.
I can see that.
And this, he'd fit right in with this story, you know. You could tell Skeeter, baby, you just got ugly real fast. Because you ain't looking so pretty anymore on page 29. Whoa.
No.
Ellie Mae.
Oh, you know, stereotypical name.
Really?
Couldn't help it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a little on the nose there, Mr. Byrne. You know, you ever watched Beverly Hillbillies? Maybe Batman fell into the cement pond. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, he fell into quicksand.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Jed Clampett is the...
Master Vampire.
Master Vampire, yeah. He's the one that's in the house, mummified. When Skeeter scratches Superman's costume and his chest, this was shocking in 1987. We were just getting used to the fact that you could actually, you know, Superman's costume could get shredded. Of course, I guess a magical creature, even pre-crisis, could have ripped through his costume. But, you know, Byrne was ripping his cape left and right because he didn't have this. His costume wasn't from Krypton anymore.
Right.
In this version, because he didn't have baby blankets because he was an embryo before he, you know, when he was launched from Krypton in the Byrne version.
Well, I mean, again, this is another thing, you know. She tore right through my costume, right through the electrochemical aura. What the flip? I mean, come on.
That is Byrne's patented mumbo-jumbo explanation of Superman's powers.
Electrochemical aura. What a load of mahooey.
See, that's the thing. When you over-explain things and you try to make things too realistic that aren't, then if you don't watch it, it'll start to fall apart. And Byrne was... I mean, I like Byrne's Superman run, don't get me wrong, but he would have whole... Just the guys on From Crisis to Crisis talked about this in the early days when they talked about the Byrne run. He would have these giant info dumps, you know, with just, you know, just...
You know why they're called dumps?
Nice. But you'd have this panel of Superman, his head off to the side, and then this just gigantic, almost, you know, this giant word balloon that looked like it was just going to smother everyone on the page, you know. I mean, and it's like, my electrochemical aura, blah, 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 blah. And I fly through, you know, forced telekinesis or something. I mean, you know, it's like, thankfully, once Byrne left, the other post-crisis Superman creators were like, you know what, he's invulnerable. Let's
start. The end.
You know. So you tell me that the Earth's lesser gravity and especially the yellow solar rays give him his powers, I'm good, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever. You explained it within the confines of the story, I'm fine. You don't need to make up more crap to explain it. When Batman impales Skeeter, that was one of those no way moments, you know, as a kid reading a comic book. You just don't get enough of those. But I mean, it was just one of those awesome, because you never saw Batman kill anybody.
See, and this is where I have a problem with this.
Okay.
Well, it was coming. Okay, Batman is supposed to value all life. He won't even kill the Joker. Okay. But it's okay for him. I mean, and it's one thing with Skeeter. He was doing it to kill, you know, he killed Skeeter in order to save Superman, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if there could have been another solution. But then he premeditates when he goes back to Gotham. I'm going to kill all these people.
They're already dead. He's not killing them.
They still have an essence of life. Was there a way to go back and save them? Did he try and find another way?
Did he have Dr. Fate on speed dial? Say, can you come over? I got a problem over here.
You know, I have an issue with that.
I don't. Batman's been killing vampires since 1939. When he fought the Monk. So I don't have any problem with that. Of course, back then he shot people and threw people into, knocked people into acid vats.
Well, I mean, it's just one of those things. Is it what you would do? But within the confines of the story, you've established that Batman doesn't take life. He's taking life.
Right. Well,
yes, it's undead life, but still, we're, you know.
Well, as for this story, of course, the Joker has, of course, murdered lots of people, but they hadn't brought the things to the personal level with Batman and the Joker yet, because Jason Todd hadn't been killed yet. Barbara Gordon hadn't been crippled yet. This is about a year before both of those stories. So it's like we were just talking at breakfast this morning for some reason, but when writers escalate the villains, what they do, and they take it to a level like that, and especially a personal level, when the heroes don't respond in kind, we don't want them to become these murderous characters that just kill anybody. But at the same time, they damage the hero, because the hero is impotent, basically.
Right.
It's like they can't
have a logical counter move.
Yes, exactly. And of course, this is a little different, but in my opinion, I've always just chopped it up to, she was dead, so Batman didn't kill anybody that was alive. She was undead, and he staked her, and that was the end of it, to me. Because that's the way vampires are treated in almost everything. It's like, this isn't the person that you love, this is some undead thing that's you know.
But by the same token, she had feelings. She had emotions.
She liked the peanut, Mr. Peanut.
She cared for her parents. She loved her parents. She, you know.
Nah.
Stick a pin in it. Agree to disagree. Move on to the next
point. I see your point, but yeah. Okay.
Move on to the next point.
Yeah. Batman can't just say, you're welcome, you know, can he? He has to be an ass about it. I owe you my life. It's like, yeah, I don't want a super vampire flying around. You know, it's like, but that ending, man, wow. I mean, that's just, I love that ending. It's like, you know, if you don't want to stay around, if you don't want to watch.
If you don't want to watch me kill these people again.
Oh, come on. Jeez. Oh, you've read way too many Twilight books. You're worried about vampires' feelings.
Shut up, Andrew.
I'm not going to make any bones about this. I love this comic. It's a near perfect single issue comic, in my opinion. There's possible plot holes. We talked about them and stuff.
Possible?
Yeah. Well, I mean, but there always are. And, you know, and like I said, I have to assume that Batman unfortunately had to stake Miss Carson as well.
Which he brought her to her death.
Well.
And he was, I mean, you think about this. Batman, the world's greatest detective, knows there's sketchy things going on in this town, but yet he brings an innocent woman into it with him. Yeah. He doesn't ensure that she's okay. He doesn't, you know, it's like the time when we were coming, when I went to a women's self-defense class taught by one of your friends.
Yeah.
And he didn't walk me to my car afterwards, and it was nighttime. He's just like, see ya. Took off around the block, and it's like 9:30 at night, and nobody else around. I'm like, thanks a lot, you douche.
Yeah. Now, you're talking about Batman. You're talking about the man who takes young boys, puts them in a bright costume, and says, come on, let's go out on the rooftops and fight guys with guns. All right! You know, so it's like...
But, you know, I mean, come on.
He's got a blind spot right there, you know? It's
like just... I want to protect the innocent, except the ones that are with me.
That's right. If you're with me, you're screwed. Yes. As soon as you step in this car, yes. Like, your life is in danger.
Forfeit.
Yeah, exactly. You know, right around this time, we're getting the introduction of the new Jason Todd with the, you know, steal the tires off the Batmobile. You know, right. Batman thinks it's a good idea to take in this kid that, you know, stole the tires off his car, stole the wheels off his car, you know. So, you know, I mean, his judgment isn't the best right through this era right here.
Apparently so. Here, I'm going to bring you to the town that I'm investigating mass murderers. I don't know what's going on. I'm not going to make sure that you have a safe place. I'm not going to make any calls about it. Oh, well, you died.
Yeah.
I'm going to stake you later.
Oh, man. A good point.
I mean, come on! Is it because she had tight little, you know, a tight little red fro? I mean, was that
a little
deal?
Perm? She had
like
an 80s perm and the frilly collar, very probably big shoulder pads.
Yeah.
And
you're not my type. I don't care about you.
Yes.
You know, not going to get any later. I don't care.
I like my women in cat costumes.
Okay, we digress. Keep going. Sorry. I digressed.
If Skeeter's family had been vampires for 100 years... Then, well, I guess we kind of brought this up before, yeah. But it just makes you wonder why no one, they must have been like, just, you know, going out and they must have been real secluded in the swamp. And whenever anybody come near them, they killed them. Or,
right.
You know, far enough away, though, that they wouldn't find them.
Uh-huh.
Or something. We're thinking about this way too much. But Byrne was, you know, he was firing on all cylinders on Superman. In a few months, he'd take over writing on Adventures of Superman. He was already doing, which was the old Superman title, and they had a new Superman title for him. And he was writing Action Comics until it became weekly. So he was in charge of all three Superman books, writing all three Superman books for a time, right around this time, not long after this. Art Adams was still a fairly new artist, and he had made a big splash at Marvel with the Longshot miniseries, who they then folded into the X-Men. I think he'd only done a few Who's Who entries before this for DC. This was the first DC comic story that he ever drew. And I've always liked his stuff. You know, the pencils are real dynamic. It's very clear storytelling, but it's evocative at the same time. And I think he out-Millered Miller. He took the Frank Miller Superman and Batman and did them better than Frank Miller, mm-hmm. in my opinion. I really liked it. It's a shame he didn't do more sequential work on DC stuff, especially Superman and Batman. You know, I was thinking about this. 1987 was kind of a big year for revisionist vampires. On film, you had The Lost Boys and Near Dark. Lost Boys came out right around the same time in the summer of 87. Okay. And Near Dark came out in the fall. And
I don't know if I've ever watched it. That's the one you were talking about where
it's like redneck vampires.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's we need to get that movie and watch it.
I know. I wish we had got it. They had it at Walmart like last year and we didn't get it. Mm. We were going to get it and then I went back to get it like a few weeks later and it was gone.
Mm.
And now you can't touch it. It's like $40.
It's out of print. Yeah. It's probably streaming, but as we've said before.
Ugh. We don't have good internet.
Yeah, it sucks. But I'm thinking that probably, you know, Anne Rice's novels were really super popular around this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know, that the reexamining of vampires and setting them in a modern setting, non-gothic
right.
setting was something fairly new. I mean, of course, I know there was some of that in the past in her novels, but, you know, I mean, they were set in modern times as well. So, you know, Skeeter's, she is downright scary after she transforms.
Right.
I mean, just hideous. But the vampire ability to change into something that monstrous, I'm not really sure. That kind of came around this time, too. You got a little bit of that in Lost Boys. They got a lot...
With the facial.
The facial things, kind of like what they did with Buffy later on.
Right, right.
And Near Dark had a little bit of that, too, as I remember. It's been so long since I saw it. But I think maybe Fright Night that came out in 85 was... that's the one that's got Roddy McDowall, where he's the horror host, and he helps the kid... The vampire's living next door to this kid. He figures out that his neighbor's a vampire.
I've not seen it. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
That's a good movie. I haven't seen that in years. But the vampires in that could change into really just monstrous looking things. So I'm wondering if that didn't influence this. Of course, that all kind of goes back to Nosferatu.
Right.
He was
right.
just, you know, nasty looking. I do think that there is some similarities between Skeeter and Carmilla. They seem to be somewhat reluctant to give in to their vampirism, you know.
Oh, I disagree.
You disagree?
Okay. I mean, I think with Carmilla, yes, but Skeeter, it was just she got caught.
Mm.
I think she fully intended to embrace the vampire lifestyle, and she just wanted someone to come. She thought there was somebody coming to help her parents become vampires again, you know. I don't think there was anything that she... She just wanted her family.
Well,
and when she couldn't have her parents, then she went out to create a new family.
Well, I could see that. Okay. All right, then I changed my mind. Okay. Well, is that all we got on this one?
I believe so.
Okay, so that'll do it for the first installment of The House of Frankenstein. And next time, we're going to, of course, return to the House of Frankenstein. Return to the return of the House of Frankenstein once more. But we're also going to return to the tragic tale of Larry Talbot, the Wolfman.
Yes.
Cue the da-da-da. Yes, Universal's favorite lycanthrope will return. This time, he's got company. Join us for Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, starring Lon Chaney Jr., of course, as the hairy one. And none other than Bela Lugosi as the Frankenstein monster. And there's a really interesting backstory about this movie that we'll get into. Plus a surprise comic related to one of these creeps, which we won't tell you about yet.
Right.
So we'll let Danny do the outro, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Comments can be left at our blog at supermatescomic.blogspot.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates Podcast. Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
Come and listen to a story about a man named Jed, former mountaineer attacked by the undead. Just one day he became monster food and started up his own vampire brood. Bloodsuckers. Nosferatu. Well, for over 100 years, old Jed's a vampire. Told Ellie Mae, your education should be higher. Said the big town is the place you ought to be, so she turned into a bat and flew to Gotham City. Cape vigilantes, crazy clowns. The Vampire Hillbillies!